Thank you very much for that introduction, Beryl, and I'm delighted to be invited to speak in a lecture dedicated to the memory of a very distinguished historian and international relations expert. And I'm going to talk about the Russian Revolution and Soviet society, but I'm also going to talk about trust and distrust. And I'll start by explaining why. In a recent book, the German historian Jörg Babirowski sets out to explain how mass atrocities occur. The book is called Räume der Gewalt, which in English means zones of violence. And Babirowski, in explaining how situations of violence arise, lays the emphasis mainly on situations themselves rather than on ideology ideology is the obvious alternative actually to what he's talking about, nor to human pathology or madness, but situations that crop up. Zones of violence are spaces in which violence against other human beings becomes normal, in which the great majority of humanity, not quite all, but most of us probably, would be capable of dominating, enslaving, torturing, and murdering other human beings. Such zones, Babirowski remarks, are places where Urvertrauen has been lost. Urvertrauen, primal trust. And he believes, as I do, perhaps rather oddly, that on the whole, human beings trust other human beings, and when they don't, situations can easily get out of hand. In a peaceful society, we trust institutions and their invisible regulations to such an extent that we take it for granted that when we leave home in the morning, we're not going to be murdered on the street. That's an extreme situation, of course, but large chunks of history, both in Europe and outside, places have become zones of violence. I believe that trust, and here I mainly mean social trust, is still an underestimated subject. In fact, it's the great unacknowledged force in human affairs, it seems to me. Trust is usually unconscious. We're not usually aware of people we're trusting. We do it out of habit. Distrust, of course, is likely to be more conscious. When you find that something you've been relying on no longer works or works imperfectly and you have to change. I maintain that trust is mediated by symbolic systems and the institutions associated with those systems. Perhaps the most important symbolic system in this respect is religion. Along, of course, with the institutions connected with religion, churches, the priesthood, seminaries, religious learning, and so on. Another symbolic system is law. Law courts, lawyers, professional associations, law faculties in universities. Another is science, and of course for a university this is a particularly valued symbolic system, and it sets up all the facilities to enable science to be pursued, as indeed do other educational systems. Culture is another. Culture in all its aspects, verbal, visual, oral, and that of course produces publication houses, orchestras, studios, training schools, and so on. And communities of one sort and another become zones of relative social trust, as indeed does the family. You might say the family is the kernel of all trust. This is not to say that communities and families are always ideal places of universal harmony, but at least they're places in which you know other people well and you know what you can trust them to do and what on the whole you can't trust them to do. The Polish sociologist Piotr Stompka postulates four preconditions for a high trust society. One is normative coherence, that is to say, the confluence of law, morality, and custom to provide a set of norms which enable people to engage confidently and peacefully with one another. I mean, law, morality, and custom are not the same thing, but if they're too far apart, too distant from each other, then it's much more difficult to establish social trust. So, normative coherence. Secondly, stability. The first condition will operate more effectively if it is long-lasting and if change takes place gradually and in a consistent direction. The third condition is openness. It's important that the structure of society and government and their functioning is as transparent as possible. I mean, complete transparency is not, in fact, desirable in matters of government, but as transparent as possible. Information about them and ideas about how things might be changed, discussion, should be as free as possible. And the fourth condition, accountability. When things go wrong, as they do even in high-trust societies, it's important that we should be able to identify who is responsible and, if possible, hold them to account. So, normative coherence, stability, openness, and accountability. Now, if you know anything about Russian society, it will be clear to you that, on the whole, it hasn't functioned high on any of these indices, except stability at certain periods. And I would say in the 19th century, Tsarist society was stable up to about the 1860s, when there were great reforms, or up to the 1880s and the 1890s, when industrialization got going fast. So, already in Tsarist Russia, already some decades, in fact, before the revolution, institutions and communities were being shaken up by the processes of industrialization and urbanization, which were really more abrupt in Russia than in most of Europe. And that meant, of course, more instability in Russia. The traditional social estates were dissolving, but had not been replaced by anything stable. Civil society organizations were multiplying in the last decades of Tsarist Russia. I'm always struck by the number of voluntary and semi-governmental organizations which existed, but they were not crowned by a satisfactory political system. The political structures at the center up to 1906 did not represent all ordinary people at all, and after 1906 only imperfectly. So you've got villagers streaming into the cities, but not acquiring their stable new identities as urban workers. Furthermore, it was often men only who went, thus weakening the family back in the village. The traditional village commune was also losing its grip in the later decades of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th. Its strongest members were either going into town or were claiming their land as private property and leaving the institutions of the village commune. Most important of all, perhaps, was a crisis in the Orthodox Church. And I say that because the Tsar's authority, which was the vital underpinning of all structures of trust and all legitimate authority in Russia, that authority rested on his status as God's anointed. The fundamental laws of the Russian Empire stated that the Tsar was to be obeyed for fear and for conscience. In other words, because he was the representative of God on earth. So that a crisis in the Orthodox Church was extremely damaging. Peasants in their villages had, on the whole, had a rather ambivalent relationship with the Orthodox Church, and many of them joined sectarian movements. But things got even worse when so many of them went into the towns where the Orthodox Church was slow to establish new parishes. And so urban workers in Russia often joined urban sectarian movements. The Baptists were particularly popular. And also became socialists, some of them. Socialism was a way for them of rediscovering the trust, a mutual trust which they'd known in the villages. Even most of the bishops in the Orthodox Church did not really approve of its structure, which they considered uncanonical. The supreme authority in the church was the Tsar, and not an elected national council, as it should have been according to canon law, as originally established in Byzantium. There was a strong movement to reform the church in 1905, 1906, but the Tsar ordered that consultation to be closed down. So the church remained unreformed in an uncanonical form, as most bishops considered. Finally, I would say that the monarchy itself was becoming desacralized, partly because of the situation in the church, but partly because of the monarchy's own mistakes in the later years of Tsarist Russia under Nicholas II. Starting in January 1905, Bloody Sunday, when peacefully demonstrating workers loyal to the Tsar, carrying portraits of the Tsar, were shot by soldiers. The Tsar was so nervous. And this, of course, was compounded by defeat in the Japanese War. Then, of course, you get the First World War, which made the situation even worse. There were a number of very serious defeats of the Russian army in 1915. They lost the whole of Poland and started losing the Baltic regions. And then came rumors spread about by a rather free press, actually, that Rasputin and the, quote, German empress — she was, of course, German by origin, but that's not unusual amongst royal families — that Rasputin and the German empress were actually trying to conclude a separate peace with the Germans and trying to undermine the war effort. Well, you add all these things up together, and Nicholas II, at least, had become somebody whom almost nobody trusted. By February 1917, not even the right-wingers, the monarchists in Russian politics, or the State Council, or the Orthodox Church, would come to Nicholas II's support. Very strikingly, on the 26th of February 1917, just before the outbreak of revolution, the Holy Synod, the supreme body in the church under the Tsar, actually refused to condemn revolutionary terror, saying, "It's not certain where the treason is coming from." It's a pretty damning thing to say about your own royal family. And when General Alexeyev, who was the chief of staff of the Russian army, asked the generals what he should do, all except one of them recommended that he should demand Nicholas II's abdication. Well, as you probably know, Nicholas II did abdicate. I think the original intention had been, obviously, to have him replaced by his heir, Alexei, who was young and a regency, but that didn't work out. The prospective regent didn't want the job, still less to become Tsar himself. And the Russian state, therefore, became a vacuum. Now, it's very dangerous when a country gets into a situation where there is no single source of authority, where there's no single unambiguous source that you can rely on. And this in the middle of a huge war, which had already made violence a routine occurrence, at least for soldiers at the front. In the opinion of Peter Holquist, an American historian who's written a lot about this, everything that followed right up to the late 1930s was a prolongation of methods of violence learnt by soldiers and by the authorities during the First World War. I wouldn't quite agree with that, but I think there's a strong point to be made there in favor. It's certainly true that in the revolution of 1917, the soldiers were really the prime movers in the breakdown of social order. They mutinied or deserted from the army, particularly in the late summer and autumn. They returned to their villages with weapons to seize the land from the landowners. Of course, the urban workers were also important in the cities, but I wouldn't say this was mainly a workers' revolution. It was a soldiers' and peasants' revolution above all. The Bolsheviks were able to seize power because, unlike the other socialist parties — and there were several, there were three or four other socialist parties — the Bolsheviks felt no responsibility for the integrity of the Russian state or for continuing the war against Germany. The other socialist parties all thought that Russia should continue to defend itself at the very least against Germany. And here I believe actually, and I disagree with Babarovsky, here I think ideology does become important. The Bolsheviks' ideology laid the basis for a whole new intensification of social distrust. Firstly, because they seized power against the wishes of the other socialist parties. Soviet revolution should really have led to a coalition socialist government, and even some Bolsheviks expected that to happen. But Lenin was determined that the government should be Bolshevik only. And he more or less got his way. Now, their ideology was both messianic and apocalyptic. That's to say, it promised a future of equality and harmony for all humanity. So it was messianic. But it was also apocalyptic in that it forecast a great final struggle before this could be achieved. And the Bolsheviks expected people to put their trust in the party to lead them through that struggle. And the word trust was very important to Bolsheviks. To return for a moment to symbolic systems and institutions, when the Bolsheviks came to power, they deliberately weakened the symbolic systems, religion, law, culture, and so on, which had been inherited from the Tsarist regime, and they deliberately set out to destroy, or at least fatally weaken, the institutions which had survived from Tsarist Russia. The church, the law courts, cultural and scientific institutions, even the family. And they tried to, as I say, destroy them or replace them with simulacra of their own, dominated by the party. So that the symbolic and institutional bulwarks of habitual trust were enfeebled or eliminated, making all routine activities much more unpredictable. And the Civil War of 1917 to 21, of course, greatly aggravated this process. It created new enmities, it stoked up old enmities, and rendered elementary everyday processes like getting food, clothing, shelter, unpredictable. In September 1918, the writer Mikhail Prishvin noted in his diary, "I can feel even the best and cleverest people, including scholars, beginning to behave as if there were a mad dog in the courtyard outside." Think about that for a moment. A mad dog in the courtyard outside. Well, you'd scarcely dare go out of your front door. In other words, a situation of what was becoming total social distrust. Civil war gave the upper hand to paranoid people with sharp reactions and a readiness to kill suspected enemies. Violence, as a political tool, became simply routine. Shoot first, ask questions afterwards. So this messianic and apocalyptic communist ideology and the circumstances of First World War, then Civil War, divided the world into, quotes, comrades and, quotes, enemies. Comrades you trust absolutely, enemies you distrust absolutely, and you try to destroy them. Now, Russian soldiers had already become accustomed to violence on the fronts of the First World War. But at least then, the distinction between friend and enemy had been pretty clear. Now, in civil war, it was often difficult to be sure who was a friend and who was an enemy. Russia was entering the zone of violence. The hypervigilant, paranoid outlook burnt itself into the mentality and the language of communists and of the ruling class in general. And this tendency was strengthened further by the organizational structure of the party, where the dichotomies of trust and distrust were emphasized and overemphasized. When a communist leader was transferred from one province to another, he would take with him his own trusted colleagues and subordinates, who had often been Civil War comrades. But then during the 1920s, leading communists who had trusted and supported each other through thick and thin, through underground, through revolution, through civil war, they now had become, by 1921, monopoly political party running the entire country. And they began to disagree about questions of policy, above all, how to build socialism. It wasn't obvious. Marx had written virtually nothing about building socialism, and Lenin certainly hadn't worked it out. And ideological and political disagreement gradually became total distrust. After all, a comrade who was anything less than 100% in agreement with you was well on the way to becoming an enemy. One interpreted situations and personalities in black and white, not in shades of grey. And during the 1920s, Stalin, who was general secretary of the party, strengthened his own position by facilitating the transfers of party secretaries along with their trusted subordinates, and at the same time manipulating them to isolate and defeat rivals. Both the left deviation, so-called, and the right opposition, so-called, were, quotes, unmasked and defeated at party congresses, quite largely through Stalin's organization. And gradually, the rhetoric escalated so that oppositionists became deviationists, then opponents with terrorist intentions, and finally, enemies of the people. Stalin took the opportunity to expel his main rival, Lev Trotsky, the leader of the left in the party, and had him expelled also from not just from the party, but from the Soviet Union. And once Trotsky was in exile, Stalin then demonized him as the enemy, you could say public enemy number one of the Soviet state. So that's high politics. But of course, this had an effect everywhere in Soviet society. These configurations of trust could not but shape the whole structure of society. If you wanted to get on in life, the thing to do was have the, quote, trust of the party. Доверие партии was an absolutely crucial category at that time. And to have the party's distrust would be fatal to your career prospects, certainly, and might easily lead to a worse fate. Ambitious young people striving to make their way in this society would present themselves on questionnaires and the like as possessing all the traits required to gain the party's trust and avoid its distrust. And they began to use the corresponding rhetoric, speaking Bolshevik, if you like. By the 1930s, a whole generation of elites were mouthing the same monochrome language, and its formulas had become compulsory in the tightly controlled media. The free expression, a discussion of alternative ideas became impossible. But it was among these usually young people making their way up under the Bolshevik regime that the enthusiasts emerge who gave the party their full support. They trusted the party, and the party trusted them. A whole generation of young men and women, women almost as much as men, grew up as committed professionals, teachers, engineers, lawyers, public officials, military officers, and also skilled manual workers who took a great pride in their involvement in the public life of their country. Some of them may have had private reservations, but they were ready to commit themselves to the project of creating a humane and harmonious society, and they were ready to offer their total trust to the party and obey the party in all circumstances in order to achieve this. And of course, their numbers actually swelled during and after the Second World War, when the Soviet victory over Nazi Germany gave them every reason to trust their country's leadership. This is one side of the trust paradox in Soviet society and should not be forgotten, because without this, the Soviet Union would probably not have survived, would not have won the Second World War, and would have collapsed from its own internal contradictions. But it had a strong cadre of trusting and trusted supporters. However, the other side of this picture is that the haste of the first five-year plans, the hellish shambles of collectivization of agriculture, and the inexperience of most administrators and many workers led to serious output shortfalls and a spate of accidents, breakdowns, and explosions. Everybody's lives were in upheaval, with new and often dangerous experiences presenting themselves every day. And the point is that communists had no alternative explanation but the intrigues and operations of enemies. They had no alternative sources of information, no alternative sources of ideas. And During the early to mid-1930s, there were many other factors which heightened both the devotion of the committed communists, but also their fears about the outside world, their distrust of the outside world, and hence the whole categories of people inside their own society who might become the agents of the outside world. You've got the Japanese invasion of Manchuria in 1931, the accession of the Nazis to power in Germany, making it their declared aim to destroy the Soviet Union. You've got the Spanish Civil War, which was a serious crisis for the Comintern, especially since Trotsky's people were so strong in Spain. And you've got then Japan's invasion of China in 1937. These processes, they were all bringing enemies, declared enemies of communism, making them stronger and bringing them closer to the Soviet border. So the whole Soviet population, and specifically the party state apparatus, had to make themselves permanently ready for war, to exercise hypervigilance. And in this atmosphere, the security police became a decisive force, the NKVD. Its function was to discover and root out enemies and potential enemies of all kinds. Its mission, if you like, was the systematic exercise of total distrust. And its outlook pervaded the whole of social life. Its imperatives were internalized by much of the population. The NKVD itself resembled a secret society. Its existence was known, but its membership, its informers, its activities, and its procedures were all guarded by a wall of total secrecy. It had informers in every workplace and a good many communal apartments where people lived. As a result, everyone had to exercise great care in their social life, constantly assessing who might be an informer keen to betray unguarded remarks. Whom to trust and whom to distrust became a vital existential question for everyone. To quote Mikhail Prishvin again, he was a writer who was by no means wholly opposed to Stalin, but he noted in his diary in October 1937, "People have completely stopped trusting each other. They devote themselves to their work and do not even whisper to one another. Gas masks are no use. What we need to protect ourselves against is psychological infection, the mask of gloom and silence." The authorities' distrust reached its apogee in the notorious NKVD order number 00447, of July 1937. It targeted a medley of, quotes, socially dangerous elements. They included former kulaks who had ended their exile sentence, former members of non-communist parties, including the other socialist parties, or white movements, officials and elites of the old regime, returned emigres, recidivist criminals, underground traders, sectarians, and members of the Orthodox Church as well, including priests. Because at a time when the danger of war was clearly growing, the regime feared that any of them might become the core of a treacherous internal opposition. Now, Stalin's personality as leader was ideally suited to this situation. As a person, he was cautious, flexible, observant, vigilant, vengeful, and ruthless. In short, he was a virtuoso operator in a society of rampant distrust. And by the mid-1930s, his distrust had shifted its focus from former members of society or oppositions to the party state apparatus itself, in other words, the people who had remained loyal to him and to the party. Many provincial party leaders, I referred to this before, had dug themselves and their comrades in, creating small sanctuaries of plenty where they could enjoy the good things of life amidst a society of scarcity. There was no real ideological conflict now, as there had been in the 1920s, but local party leaders were committed to the defense of their power and privileges. Some of them actually tried to resist or at least delay the implementation of central commands which inflicted dreadful suffering on their local populations. Others, on the other hand, worked towards the regime by exceeding the arrest quotas laid before them. In mid-1934, Stalin referred to these provincial party secretaries as appanage princes, roughly in English, medieval barons. And he had come to a situation where he felt he could not trust them any longer to carry out his own orders, though in fact most of them were almost undeviatingly loyal. At the Central Committee plenum of February to March 1937, Stalin made a very important speech, and I'll quote chunks of it because it gives you an idea of the language which leading communists were using. What Stalin said was that agents of foreign states have been conducting their wrecking, diversionary, and espionage work with the active participation of Trotskyists, affecting to a greater or less extent all or almost all our economic, administrative, and party organizations. They have wormed their way not only into lower level organizations, but into some top responsible posts as well. And these agents' strength, according to Stalin, lay in the fact that they held party membership cards. I quote again, the party card grants them political trust and opens access for them to all our institutions and organizations. They have deceived our people, have abused that trust, have discreetly practiced their wrecking and betrayed our state secrets to enemies of the Soviet Union. Some comrades, both in the center and locally, have not only failed to discern the true face of these wreckers, diversionists, spies, and murderers, but have proved so careless, naive, and benevolent as quite often to smooth the way for the promotion of these agents of foreign powers to responsible posts. The only way to tackle this danger is to remember that the Soviet Union is surrounded by hostile powers and to exercise vigilance, real Bolshevik revolutionary vigilance. Well, as you will know, Stalin dramatized this narrative and this rhetoric in the show trials of 1936-8, in which grotesque charges were laid against Lenin's comrades, against loyal party leaders, accused of being foreign spies, wreckers, diversionists, and so on. You'll see what the language is. And mostly they confessed. The reasons for that are not clear, but may have something to do with the pressures, after all, that were exercised against them, including in some cases torture, or fear of damaging life for their families, or the fact that they had themselves no alternative narrative with which to explain what had happened to them, other than to say that, yes, I have become an enemy of the party. It's a terrifying thought. Meanwhile, Stalin projected an image of himself together with the faceless Central Committee, faceless because many of its real members had been arrested and accused of incredible crimes. Stalin and this faceless Central Committee, staunch defenders of the heritage of Lenin, had been steering their courageous and undaunted path through throngs of double dealers, traitors and terrorists, all of them enemies, attempting to destroy the Soviet Union and restore capitalism. This was all laid out in Stalin's short course of the history of the Russian Communist Party. Did Stalin actually believe the grotesque fantasies on the basis of which he accused and murdered his enemies? That is really impossible to say. I think it's quite probable that he did, because he and the other Bolshevik leaders had created such an all-encompassing narrative of total trust and total distrust that they themselves had to follow it through to the bitter end, whether or not they fully believed it. Even those who were convinced that they themselves were innocent of the charges against them, could not feel sure that those accused alongside them were equally blameless. They simply had no alternative narrative with which to explain what had gone wrong. So in most cases, it's impossible to say whether they denounced enemies out of conviction or cynically to save their own skin. The key point is that universal distrust was now the modus operandi of the entire system. Yet all the leading actors were under an inner compulsion to declare total trust in the party. And that's the other side of the picture. Total trust, total distrust. If one looks further down the NKVD ladder at the operatives who actually had to apply terror against ordinary people, who had to arrest them and incarcerate them and interrogate them, they were quite different from the nomenclatura elite, and they've been the subject of some remarkable research by the Russian scholar Alexander Vatlin. And he shows that the majority of NKVD operatives at the local level had less than complete secondary education and had risen from mostly the peasantry, in any case from humble social origins, during the World War and the Civil War. They had picked up habits of military discipline in the Red Army, and they were absolutely loyal to their military commanders and later their civilian patrons, because without that, you know, you couldn't get on in life. They had good reason to be loyal, since many of them had some, quote, defect in their past biography, which they did not want revealed. They were in constant fear of losing their privileges and their material comforts, and of becoming victims of the process which they themselves were driving forward. They did not understand the official ideology in any depth, and they constantly feared making mistakes. They behaved pretty much as criminal bands do, including fear-induced submission to authority, an honor code, mutual assurances, the ritual division of spoils, and there were spoils to be had from the victims, and the use of coded language. Vatlin asserts that it is improbable that the operatives believed in the conspiracies they were supposed to be unveiling and investigating, but they had to convince themselves of the logic of the basic accusations. And I would add that the milieu of general distrust was mitigated only by the forced trust they placed in each other. They hung together or they hung separately. None of them probably knew quite what to believe. Anyone who hesitated in this kind of situation was doomed. And that's what enabled Stalin to indulge his desire for untrammeled power and his ruthless drive to get rid of all conceivable, quotes, enemies. But if one can believe a passage in Khrushchev's memoirs, this intense and permanent distrust took its toll of Stalin too. Khrushchev records that much later in 1951 or 52, towards the end of Stalin's life, Khrushchev and Stalin were alone together on a balcony, break of a meeting. And Stalin suddenly said to him, "I'm done for. I don't trust anyone. I don't even trust myself." Khrushchev so flabbergasted at this unexpected statement that he didn't respond in any way. And after half a minute or so, Stalin ushered him back inside the meeting hall. Well, if we can trust Khrushchev's testimony, Stalin himself had reached the logical end point of the process which had hoisted him to supreme power. Well, eventually, in the 1930s, the dysfunctionality of the mutual destruction presumably became obvious even to Stalin. Terror had removed key personnel from the administration, the police, the armed forces, and those who had not been arrested were often too terrified to take necessary decisions. It was also very difficult to find reliable replacement cadres. Even Stalin could not exercise power if the levers of that power were broken. So in late 1938, he began to circulate instructions that denunciations were to be much more carefully examined before action was taken. And the terror was gradually toned down thereafter. He kept terror as a weapon, but he never again used it so undiscriminately. And by the late 1930s, and even more, much more after the Second World War, Soviet ideology had begun to create its own antibodies to virulent distrust. Narratives of stability, normality, historical inevitability and historical memory, and it had begun to codify and consolidate its own rituals, customs and practices, creating a society in which habitual interaction became more common. So indiscriminate terror came to an end in 1939, and it was eased even further after Stalin's death. But the fear of terror and the shadow of widespread distrust remained in the population, especially but not only older people, right up to the end of the Soviet Union. It still hung heavily over people in the mid-1960s when I first went to the Soviet Union. Many people managed to improvise a small circle of friends and acquaintances whom they learned to trust by repeated contact and monitoring. And actually the construction after Stalin's death of an incredible number of flats in new living blocks of housing made this much simpler. You, instead of living in communal apartments, each family usually had a flat to itself where it could keep its own affairs secret. That made it much easier to trust within the family and outside it. Some friends and acquaintances would be trusted for certain purposes only, such as obtaining scarce consumer goods or mediating contact with influential officials. With other friends, one might even feel able to speak freely in a closed circle. Some scientific and cultural institutions became tiny oases of free speech, where colleagues felt at ease with each other. On the other hand, other scientific and cultural institutions were riven by disputes between rival factions, struggling either for ideological hegemony or for preferential access to the good things of life. In all cases, the radius of trust was limited. You might trust an employer who dispensed favors effectively, or colleagues who would refrain from making a denunciation, or friends who would offer emotional support and perhaps help out materially in a crisis. In the non-Russian republics, ethnic patron-client networks fulfilled the same kind of function. And of course, that's one reason why, when the USSR eventually fell apart, what the result was, 15 ethnically named republics. The point is that people could not, on the whole, trust the state and social institutions, the police, the law courts, the media, even religious associations. They could not usually be relied on to offer effective assistance in critical situations. And this phenomenon, the limited radius of trust, the inadequacy of official institutions, continues to characterize post-Soviet Russia. Now, been talking about Russia. And we tend to look down on Russia. Yes, we do. A lot of comment on Russia in the press and even by respectable historians in the West is often very condescending about Russia. Indeed, in some cases, I would call it Russophobic. But we have no necessary reason to be complacent. Trust, social trust, tends to create rigid boundaries around itself, especially in conflict situations, and across those boundaries, distrust is projected. When serious dilemmas arise within a system demanding total trust, the collective has to ask itself where those boundaries lie. If members of the group begin to express doubts, they can suddenly find themselves on the other side of a boundary which in itself remains rigid and unforgiving. And distrust is as contagious as trust. Once it sets in, It takes hold in an abrupt and cumulative way, which individual actors find it almost impossible to resist. Incidentally, this is the way that financial crises occur. And we've seen that 10 years ago, which has played a very serious role, I think, in intensifying distrust, social distrust, in most Western countries. And we're seeing the consequences of that in the rise of especially right-wing nationalist populist parties with authoritarian leaders all over Europe. Now, the Soviet Union in the 1930s was, of course, one of the most extreme cases of social distrust. But today, the late 20th and early 21st centuries, there are abundant examples of terrorist movements, genocidal movements in some cases, ferally destructive wars, which have resulted from the uncontrolled escalation of distrust into murderous fear and hatred. Zones of violence are still very much with us today, and we must be aware of the danger of slipping into them. In Britain, earlier this year, a newspaper dubbed Judges Who Decided That Parliament Must Approve the Brexit Process, Enemies of the People, and was not instantly rebuked by the Ministry of Justice. That is a dangerous echo, and this is a dangerous process. We're not far along it at the moment. Levels of social trust are still pretty high in Britain, but it's something we have to be aware of, and the fate of the Soviet Union is an example, not something to look down on. Thank you.